Before I begin, this episode discusses eating disorders. So if this topic is not comfortable for you, just go ahead and skip this one, and I'll hang out with you next time. Love you. And in addition to the feeling of being full, there was another more terrifying one, as if 100 appetites were raging out of control within her. She couldn't explain it, but she felt as if everything was in chaos, and something awful was going to happen. She had eaten, and now something terrible was going to occur. Stephen Levikron, the best little girl in the world. As you may know, I have been celebrating my 5th anniversary, which was in April, by revisiting and updating my first 5 years of episodes, in a sense looking at my first 5 years of podcasting through a new lens. I decided to jump ahead to episode 36, Chasing That Skinny, in which I interviewed Eli Sirota, a fellow podcaster and friend, and we both talked about our past dealing with our eating disorders. I decided to go ahead and revisit this one because of what's been going on in reality TV and social media in the past 2 weeks. For those of you who do not watch The Real Housewives, I'm referring to The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. What's going on goes back to last season, when Sutton, a self-described Southern Belle, I disagree because of her lack of manners, but anyway, walked into Crystal's room, her hotel bedroom, with only a perfunctory knock to bring her coat. No one asked her to, but anyway, on a girl's trip. Crystal was in the midst of changing clothes and was naked. Crystal, because of body issues past and present, had a panic response and hit the floor to cover herself. Sutton, instead of bowing graciously out of the room, continued to stare at Crystal and further made a joke. The rest of the women, for the rest of the season, took issue not with Sutton, but with Crystal, telling Crystal that her description of her feelings was too intense, that she couldn't use the word violated to describe how she felt about the situation, which then basically forced her into a corner and forced her to disclose that she had had an eating disorder. She had to disclose to explain how strongly she felt about Sutton standing there, staring at her body and making a joke so that her friends would leave her alone. Fast forward to this season. Crystal is now, in these past 2 weeks, talking about her eating disorder and talking about how she is currently struggling. The response by the other cast members has possibly been triggering for people and has been harsh enough that the Housewives show has put up a "if you need support" screen at the end of episodes, which I'm not certain they've ever done before. Most of them have ignored it in a "ew, that's icky" kind of way to Crystal's face, and then discussed it behind her back with each other. Some responded with a, "Oh, you're so pretty, you have such an amazing body," which is a big no-no. It's dismissive at best, and so invasive and triggering. I know that word is so overused, but it is appropriate here. Eating disorders are not about trying to achieve a desirable body type. Not completely. Crystal talks about having body dysmorphia, which means that she does not perceive her body as it realistically is. She wasn't heard, in my opinion, not at all. Erica, who I normally like, despite all of her legal problems, which I'm not going to get into because it's not appropriate, has been drinking a lot lately, and she is wide open when she drinks. And she said some things she absolutely should not have said, like suggesting laxatives to Crystal as a purgative, and teasing her with an appetizer at a party. "You can't eat this, it's a chicken finger." Ugh, God. Kyle asked questions about Crystal's eating disorder without asking permission first, as did Erica. The questions were sensible, you know, does she restrict or pinch? Does she purge? But don't ask details about someone's mental illness unless you ask permission first. Can we talk about it? Is it okay if I ask questions about it? Because it might not be the time or place to discuss details, and or the person might not be in a safe headspace to explain how they don't eat and purge if they do, which is what I did. Just talking about it can put your body in an unsafe place. Cortisol, adrenaline, fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. It's really not simply a conversation. So because all this uncomfortable stuff is going on reality TV and continuing on social media, because these ladies don't know how to behave, you know that. And Crystal is having trouble protecting herself and feeling safe. I thought it'd be a good time to jump to this episode in my revisiting my first 5 years. Good timing. So before I replay this interview, which was recorded for National Eating Disorders Week, I'll talk about my eating disorder. I am currently healthy. I track my food through the LifeSum app and am safe and healthy doing it under the supervision of my gastroenterologist to manage all the wonderful bowel symptoms that go along with Ehlers-Danlos and fibromyalgia. And I will spare you the details. Just suffice it to say, I don't digest food well at all. I'm able to track my food by looking at types on the app. Vegetables, fruit, fish, water, etc. without obsessing about numbers. I can enjoy making positive changes in my diet without then ruminating about them and ruminating about the changes they're making to my body. Like no longer drinking soda. I haven't had soda since I worked, which was 2014, which I'm kind of proud of. Drinking mostly water, drinking only one caffeinated coffee per day. I highly recommend Grounds and Hounds Decaf. They support shelter dogs. I'll put the link in the show notes. I'm able to watch for disordered eating habits and talk to my therapist about them and change them myself. I haven't been active in my eating disorder since my early 20s, and I'm now 50. I was an anorexic purging type. What this means is I didn't eat, but when I had to, for social reasons or my body demanded it, then I would make myself sick. I did do damage to myself, my throat, my teeth, which are already also weakened by Ehlers-Danlos. I had a weird relationship with my body because I knew something was wrong, but had not been diagnosed with anything yet. And I was also very curvy and had been since the fourth grade. Boobs in the fourth grade, not good. Unexplained pain and sweats and intolerance to heat and wooziness, plus a lot of thickness, just messed with me. Then I had issues with my little brother, Eric, who I talked about on the podcast, dying in our childhoods. So I had trauma on top of everything else. So you add complex PTSD into all of these body issues. My reasons were control much more than the need to be thin, per se. Did I buy into my culture's drive to be thin? Yes, I did. I won't lie. I was a teen during the Kate Moss era. The look was called heroin chic. Quote, the nerves of the skin send pain signals to the brain to warn us of the danger from an impending injury. In the case of self-inflicted wounding, this pain acts as the body's own defense mechanism to stop one from proceeding in the effort at physical injury. If the person proceeds despite the pain, this means that he or she is motivated by something stronger than the pain, something that makes him or her capable of ignoring or enduring it. Stephen Levikron. My heart is with Crystal. I can't imagine my issues being spread across TV and social media like this, especially by my friends, and having no control. I'm choosing to discuss my eating disorder on my podcast, and I'm choosing how I discuss it and how I receive responses to it. I'm not getting comments about using laxatives, probing questions, and not being told I can't eat something at a Christmas party in front of everybody. If you need to speak to someone about concerns about disordered eating in yourself or someone else, you can contact the National Eating Disorders Helpline at 800-931-2237. The number for the UK is 01 494-793-223. The number for Eating Disorders Victoria in Australia is 1-300-550-236. These phone numbers and the anonymous click to chat address for the helpline are in the show notes and will also be in the website entry for this episode. There's also a self-screening test for eating disorders in the show notes for age 13 and up as a tool. And now, here's my interview with Eli. Thank you, as always, for listening into my sixth year. I hope you all are well and taking very good care of yourselves. You deserve it, as do I. I love you. I am angry that I starved my brain and I sat shivering in my bed at night instead of dancing or reading poetry or eating ice cream or kissing a boy. Laurie House Anderson, Winter Girls. Hi, this is Carla and welcome once again to There Might Be Cupcakes. This episode's title, Chasing That Skinny, comes from something my interviewee, Eli Sirota, said as we discussed eating disorders, and it really struck me. Granted, for me, my eating disorder was not about thinness, but rather control, but the obsession with what my behavior was doing to my body was most certainly there, and I most certainly did think I was fat, and I most certainly was not fat. Before I play the interview, please let me apologize for the sound quality. This is Eli's recording. God bless him for making a backup. For my recording died the inexplicable digital corruption death that happens every once in a while. His voice is beautifully clear. Mine originally sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher in Peanuts. Mwah, mwah. Yeah. I salvaged that as best I could with my meager digital skills. My voice is not the most dulcet of tones on the best day, and it's not real sweet here. But I think this interview's worth a listen, so please hang in there with us. A quick intro to eating disorders in general, if you will allow me to dust off my master's degree in counseling. When I refer to eating disorders in this episode, I am referring to the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition, Diagnoses of Anorexia, Bulimia, and Binge Eating Disorder. Anorexia is defined by the DSM as, quote, persistent restriction of energy intake leading to significantly low body weight in context of what is minimally expected for age, sex, developmental trajectory, and physical health, accompanied by, quote, either an intense fear of gaining weight or of becoming fat, or persistent behavior that interferes with weight gain, even though significantly low weight. And, quote, disturbance in the way one's body weight or shape is experienced, undue influence of body shape and weight on self-evaluation, or persistent lack of recognition of the seriousness of the current low body weight. So, refusal to eat, an untoward fear of becoming fat, or determined behavior that interferes with weight gain, even though you're of normal weight or underweight. And the inability to see your body shape for what it is, and to see the seriousness of your situation. I lift my arm out of the water. It's a log. I put it back under and it blows up even bigger. People see the log and call it a twig. They yell at me because I can't see what they see. Nobody can explain to me why my eyes work different than theirs. Nobody can make it stop. Laurie House Anderson, Winter Girls. There are two subtypes of anorexia, restricting type, which is what is traditionally thought of as anorexia, and eating purging type, which is what I had. This type does occasionally eat, sometimes to binging levels, I didn't, then purging to rid the body of that food. I would eat usually to ease social tension and then make myself vomit.
Bulimia is defined by the DSM as, quote, recurrent episodes of binge eating. An episode of binge eating is characterized by both of the following: eating, in a discrete period of time, an amount of food that is definitely larger than most people would eat during a similar period of time and under similar circumstances, and a sense of lack of control over eating during the episode, e.g., a feeling that one cannot stop eating or control what or how much one is eating, and, quote, recurrent inappropriate compensatory behavior in order to prevent weight gain, such as self-induced vomiting, misuse of laxatives, diuretics, or other medications, fasting, or excessive exercise. The binge eating and inappropriate compensatory. I should have to write that 100 times. Behaviors both occur on average at least once a week for 3 months. Again, as with anorexia, self-perception is disordered. Quote, self-evaluation is unduly influenced by body shape and weight. Plus, in giving the diagnosis of bulimia, anorexia must first be excluded. You always start with anorexia, then go to bulimia. Quote, the disturbance does not occur exclusively during episodes of anorexia nervosa. Although neither Eli nor I suffered from binge eating disorder, it still needs to be discussed, for it isn't discussed often, and so has more shame associated with it. It is not a personal failure or a character flaw. It is a compulsion and an addictive behavior that requires professional help to cease, just like anorexia and bulimia. If you are suffering with any of these three disorders, you can contact the National Eating Disorders Helpline at 1-800-931-2237. The number for the UK is 01-494-793-223. The number for Eating Disorders Victoria in Australia is 1-300-550-236. These phone numbers and the anonymous click-to-chat address for the helpline are in the show notes and will also be in the website entry for this episode. Binge eating disorder is diagnosed per the DSM as, quote, recurrent episodes of binge eating characterized by both the following: eating, in a discrete period of time, an amount of food that is definitely larger than most people would eat during a similar period of time and under similar circumstances, and a sense of lack of control over eating during the episode, e.g., a feeling that one cannot stop eating or control what or how much one is eating. The binge eating episodes are associated with three or more of the following: 1. Eating much more rapidly than normal. 2. Eating until feeling uncomfortably full. 3. Eating large amounts of food when not feeling physically hungry. 4. Eating alone because of feeling embarrassed by how much one is eating. 5. Feeling disgusted with oneself, depressed, or very guilty afterwards. Marked distress regarding binge eating is present, and binge eating occurs on average at least once a week for 3 months. Again, binge eating disorder is diagnosed exclusionary of anorexia and bulimia. You start with anorexia, exclude it, and go to bulimia, exclude it, and go to binge eating disorder. Final quote from the DSM, quote, note, binge eating disorder is less common but much more severe than just overeating. Binge eating disorder is associated with more subjective distress regarding the eating behavior and commonly other co-occurring psychological problems. The reason Eli wanted to speak up for National Eating Disorders Week is that eating disorders are feminized, but 1 in 3 people struggling with an eating disorder is male. And when you take into account quote-unquote subclinical disorder behaviors, i.e. severely disordered behaviors that do not fall under those three DSM diagnoses, like purging without any other behaviors, binging without any other qualifying behaviors, laxative abuse without any other behaviors, obsessive exercising, these behaviors are as common in men as they are in women. In the United States, 10 million men will struggle with an eating disorder during their lifetime. 10 million. 30 million people of all genders will. According to the National Eating Disorders Week website, 16% of transgender college students self-report as currently struggling with an eating disorder of some type. Eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any mental illness. 1 in 5 deaths for anorexia are actually by suicide. The mortality risk for eating disorders is actually higher for men than for women. Plus, there's actually layers upon layers of stigma for men in admitting they need help, and then in seeking and receiving help. First, as I said, eating disorders are feminized. Cheerleaders, gymnasts, Barbie dolls. Plus, seeking psychological help can be said to be feminized as well, seeming the purview more of women. Finally, and here comes my degree again, the assessment tests currently used for screening for eating disorders use gender bias language, which can lead to more discomfort and therefore barriers to treatment before treatment even begins. I breathe in slowly. Food is life. I exhale. Take another breath. Food is life. And that's the problem. When you're alive, people can hurt you. It's easier to crawl into a bone cage or a snowdrift of confusion. It's easier to lock everybody out. But it's a lie. Laurie House Anderson, Winter Girls. And so, I introduce Eli Sirota, my friend, and the podcaster behind the not-so-crazy podcast of Blizzard the Wizard and Eli.
I'm recording, and I'm ready to go whenever you are.
All right. Okay. But you could just tell me again how National Eating Disorder Awareness Week got your attention.
Well, I mean, I guess it was the first one after my recovery and stuff. This was the moment where, you know, I went to Facebook and I, you know, went public, I guess, about my eating disorder, made it Facebook official, as our generation would call it.
Yeah.
So it's always just kind of had this significance for me of, you know, just being open about it, because I feel like for men, it, you know, it's important to share our stories, because there's such a stigma about eating disorders, how it's, you know, mostly for females to go through, but men do it as well. So whenever I can get an opportunity during, I guess it's almost like an excuse as well to kind of talk about it, because I'm not the dude who likes to bring up my opinions about stuff a lot, so when this week comes around, it kind of, you know, it gives me an excuse to kind of do that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and even with men, it seems, from my point of view, that the only acceptable eating disorder is working out and using supplements.
Right.
Now, if you're gonna do it, then you're hitting the gym, and, you know, So straight up anorexia, that's what girls,
hey, I mean, it's just the way we're growing up. You know, the girls have the Barbies. The guys have these, like, super jacked toys we all play with. Just from our youth, we're taught these are the ideal bodies.
Yeah. So, you told me a little about how it started in front of your family, right?
Correct. My mom had some struggles before I was even born. And I know there are studies that show that eating disorders are genetics. So my grandma might have gone through it. My kids, who knows, they might be more likely just because they have my genetics in them.
Do you know if she was actively struggling while she was pregnant with you?
I do not know that. I never really asked her about that. When I was in the hospital, though, there was a girl who was pregnant and being hospitalized. So I know it does happen to people. I mean, I can understand, you know, when you're so worried about your weight, all of a sudden you have to eat so much more because there's another body inside of you, and that could probably be a huge trigger for some people.
Oh, yeah. So much extra body stuff going on during pregnancy.
Yeah. And there's just so much you don't have control over, too, and that's another thing about eating disorders is for some people it's about that control of having, you know, in a world where we have such little control, that's one thing they can have control over.
Yeah. that's what it was for me. It really wasn't the food or the fat. It was the control.
You kind of told me a little bit about your story, and I mean, that's like one thing I'm always afraid of, because I'm Jewish, and a lot of the Jewish holidays involve fasting, and since my, you know, recovery, I haven't done it, because I'm always nervous if I go through a day of fasting without eating, and I'm like, oh, I could do it, that's easy, it's going to kickstart all those thoughts again. So, I mean, you mentioned that, I was like, yeah, that's one of my biggest fears, and why I don't fast at all.
Yeah, for me, it's been difficult being chronically ill for the same reason, because my job 24/7 is my body, and I have to track my food, and for a long time I struggled with that because it made me so uncomfortable to write down everything I ate, for everything to be about what goes in my body. But it's been a real blessing because it's taught me how to celebrate taking care of myself instead of obsessing about it.
Right.
And I've learned how to be okay with being overweight, because, you know, I'm overweight, but my God, I'm alive. You know, I've got these disorders, but I'm alive, man. You know?
Yeah, there's so much more to live for than just your external appearance. You know, you gotta be happy with who you are on the inside, and that was one of my big struggles, was just, I wanted to be liked so badly, because I didn't really like myself, and I needed that validation from other people. But, I mean, with my podcast and just all the stuff I do, it's all about, you know, who's Eli? Being able to say, you know, I'm Eli, and I'm okay with that, because Eli's he's a great human being, you know, there's nothing wrong with being me.
Exactly. We talked about, you know, before, the different types.
Mm-hmm.
You were strictly anorexic, or?
And I was, like, running a lot on top of just not eating that much.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm. When did it start for you? How young were you?
Well, I mean, the seeds were planted growing up. Like, you know, with my mom, she was always, you know, whatever the diet of the week was, she was trying those things. She was always chasing that skinny, and my dad was always saying, you know, let's go to the gym. He's like, oh, don't eat that fried food. Don't eat that chocolate, you know. So he was just kind of making me feel fat my whole life. And then the summer in between my freshman and sophomore year of college, just naturally, I lost some weight. And people at college and girls and stuff, they were starting to notice, like, oh, wow, you know, you look good. You lost some weight. And just kind of, you know, just society, we all want that feeling when people compliment you on your looks. And I started chasing that more and more. And then, like, it was slow until my junior year. The next year, it got really bad. It got out of control there. And then it ended with me being in the hospital.
And when were you hospitalized?
The summer in between my junior and senior year of college. That was the summer of 2013.
Wow, so you went from freshman year of high school to junior year of college.
Oh, no, sorry, freshman and sophomore year of college was when it started. So it was like a year and a half, 2 years. I guess 2 years was when from start to hospitalize.
Okay. Sorry, that's some shit. Wow. What was hospital like? Because I was never hospitalized.
I mean, it was,
I somehow bootstrapped my way out of it.
I have such respect for you, because I don't know if I would have been able to do it without, you know, that process, although it was actually, like, you know, admitting to myself, and, like, when I, you know, because I was at that point, like, I had to write it down. I think my parents couldn't force me to go in at that point because of my age. So, you know, I was sitting in, like, a therapist office with my therapist and my parents. They were just, you know, breaking down the walls. And, like, when I finally admitted that, you know, I got to go to the hospital. That was my thing. I was always, you know, oh, I'm bad, but I'm never going to be in the hospital. So that was kind of like that broken moment, you know. And then I was able to get better, and in the hospital I was ready. And I mean, there are so many, just, you know, everyone in there, everyone's story is different, but we all just had those similarities, so everyone was able to connect with each other. And there was a lot of group therapy sessions where we all just share our stories. You know, everyone was just doing, like, art stuff, and it was a very creative environment, which I really liked. I was able to do some good doodles. I tried doing some poems and stuff. There are just great people in there, and you always saw new people come in and old people leave, and you're always happy when you see people leave.
Mm-hmm.
But some people just get so accustomed to it, like, their whole lives are just in and out of hospitals. It's sad. There were a couple people that were, you know, like, third or fourth trips in the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah.
were you the only male in there? Or?
There was one other kid. He was in high school, and he didn't think he had any problems. But he was only in there for like a week, like a weekend while I was there. He was gone pretty quickly. So for the majority of it, I was the only male.
Mm. How did the other girls react to you?
They were all really nice to me. They were kind. I mean, I think it's crazy, but this facility was kid-friendly. So there was like 10-year-olds in the hospital, which, I mean, at that age, like, they don't understand what's going on with them. Like, one of them I talked to, they kind of looked up to me a little bit. And, I mean, now, like, 4 years later, they're starting to understand a little bit more, like, the feelings that, you know, it's not just like the dark boogeyman. It's, you know, something's going on in their life. And, I mean, at 10 years old, they can't comprehend that stuff. So to be in the hospital was, I mean, geez.
That's what, fifth grade?
Ooh. Yeah.
Wow. Do you do any outreach beyond talking online about, you know, this week and your experience? Oh. Have you thought about doing stuff for career, you know, being a therapist?
I mean, I feel like I would have to go back to school and get some degrees for that stuff. There's just way too much reading, and, I mean, doing that stuff, I mean, you got to have, like, a mental strength to be able to talk to these people and just, you know, some of their stories are just, you know, there's so much going on in their lives and just,
yeah.
I mean, my mom's a therapist, and I mean, she does, like, kids and art therapy and stuff, so just to hear those young kids talk, you know, sharing their life stories and how sad they are, I mean, you got to be a really, you know, special person to be able to handle all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, before I became disabled, I was a counselor. And there is something called compassion fatigue, where you burn out if you take too much on of other people's stuff.
Right.
Yeah. And I can imagine that would be especially difficult in the eating disorders and self-harm field.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be nice at some point to be able to, like, do, like, you know, like, a public talk, like, hey, guys, you know, go, like, to a college or something, that's where we're not experienced, and kind of just do almost like a Q&A with it. I work at a college, so every year I'm always like, all right, I'm going to reach out to them, I'm going to do it, but I always chicken out. I mean, this is the first year I'm kind of doing, like, you know, a bunch of podcasts talking about it, so hopefully, you know, I'll have a little bit more confidence, and then next year I'll be able to do something.
And you can use the podcast as part of your portfolio. Like, check this out, guys.
Right.
I think that would be great. Speaking of the colleges, that would be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there needs to be more visibility for guys because, like I said, there's, even with the guys that have eating disorders, there's a certain look to it.
Yeah.
Okay, you can, but it has to be masculine.
Right, and it's hard for men to be open about this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any friends that are male that have any disorders? Do you have any friends or peers? Or do you feel kind of isolated?
I mean, no one's ever, like, told me they've had one before, and I'm not the type of person who's going to, like, judge people, like, oh, you know, everyone's got their own stories, and I'm not trying to judge people or anything, so if no one tells me, I'm not going to be able to know. But
yeah.
So I definitely, I'm probably at work the only one, but, I mean, at this point in my life, I'm kind of, I mean, it's still on my mind all the time, you know, if I'm like, oh, I'm so busy, I can't eat, I gotta ask myself, am I really busy, or are these those thoughts coming back, and, like, they're always around, but as far as the eating goes, that's gotten a lot easier, and, like, I sometimes, I guess, you know, I just go and eat whatever I'm in the mood for, I'm not looking online at nutritional information, it's like, all right, what's got the least amount of calories, what's got no fat, I just, I'm like, I'm in the mood for this, I'm gonna go eat this.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's...
It's a good feeling when you realize that and you see that in yourself and go, oh, I just ate that because I wanted to.
Exactly, yeah, it is a good feeling.
Yeah, and I've been able to rechannel some of the drives into taking care of myself. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you want to obsess about something? Well, how about you obsess about tracking your pain? How about you obsess about tracking your, you know, your supplements and your nutrition? Rechannel that into something good, you know.
Yeah.
You've got a lot going on. Track that. And sometimes, you know, you can't make the obsessiveness go away. That's part of your nature, but you can make it positive.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah, for me, it was control. It was never about food or fat or anything like that. And it really started by accident.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember it. I was in Hempstead, I think, and it was a day, I was a teacher's work day, and it was about 2 o'clock, and I realized I hadn't had anything, and no water, had anything, and I'm proud of myself. I didn't think I could do that. And that's how I started. It was an accident.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of, I guess you kind of see, like, you know, like, right where it started, but for some, you know, you never think, like, oh, I'm just going to go through an eating disorder. It's just, like, the word wasn't even in my head till junior year when my parents saw a picture of me. And this was, like, a year after I was doing this stuff. Like, you know, we think you might have an eating disorder. I mean, up until that point, that word was never even, you know, in my head. Like, I didn't even think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mom being a therapist definitely was good, you know, because she was able to pick up, like, she saw some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was definitely a huge help. But sometimes it made it worse, because the more they tried to help, you know, it's like, oh, they're doing this, I got to do this stuff to balance it out. And balancing out meant, you know, not eating more, you know, going for longer runs and stuff. So until I got to that point where, you know, that bottom, like, the more they tried to help, the worse it got. Just because, like, that voice in your head's telling you this stuff, and it's isolating you from so many people. Like, I lost so many friends that, you know, during that junior year when it got really bad, just because these were people that knew me before the eating disorder. So I was like, oh, they're going to know something's wrong. I don't want those judgmental eyes on me and stuff. So I was like, oh, so I started isolating myself and making friends who didn't know me before, because then they were just thinking, oh, this is just Eli. There's nothing odd about this behavior.
Do you think you lost those friends because of you isolating yourself, or do you think it was all you?
I mean, it's a two-way street, you know. I mean, but if I wasn't, you know, I was, like, isolating myself a lot and just not talking to them, and they might have tried to communicate with me, and then I just kind of not ignored them. I was like, oh, I can't today, guys, sorry. Like, you know, I saw some people that, you know, senior year of college, I was trying to talk to them, and it was hard. I mean, I kind of built some bridges back up with some of the people, but there were some of them that I just couldn't do it, you know.
Yeah.
But it's a shame sometimes. Like, what you do damage to more than just yourself when you go through these sort of things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Well, is there anything, if you could talk to your younger self before you started any project?
Just that, you know, no one's against you. People aren't, you know, trying to sabotage you if they're trying to help you. You know, they're trying to help you. They care about you. They don't want to see you die because, you know, it's the ending point, because the more you do this stuff, the more your body is not working properly because it's not getting the right, you know, it's not getting enough energy. It's not getting, you know, needs food. And, like, your brain starts getting twisted because your brain's not getting the proper nourishment. So it's twisted and it's thinking everything's against you and it's trying to, you know, just keep you alone. But, I mean, just that's not real. Like, you know, as soon as I was, like, in the hospital, as soon as I was getting better and my brain was working properly, I was like, wow, what was I doing? Like, why was I doing this stuff? This is crazy. What were these thoughts? I mean, how did I think this was normal?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not normal, these thoughts. Your brain's not getting the proper nourishment. So, you know, trust these people. They want to help you. They want to see you get better. And eating isn't the end of the world. You know, there's nothing to be afraid of with food.
That's perfect. It's absolutely perfect. You said that, you mentioned that it affects the Jewish holidays, the fasting.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other way that you see it interfering in your daily lifestyle?
Not as much anymore. I mean, I guess sometimes, you know, it's always, like, on my mind, but it's not, you know, just because I'm always nervous about stuff, and, you know, I'm just a nervous human being, but, you know, sometimes if work's been busy and I'm not eating as much, I gotta be like, hey, you know, let's go get something, you know, let's get some wings, let's eat, you know, there's nothing wrong with eating, you gotta keep that stuff in,
mm-hmm.
You know, just trying to keep the 3 meals a day and snacks sometimes, just trying to keep all that stuff. I guess that's just the main thing, just making sure I'm still eating and always having food and stuff, never starving or anything.
Mm-hmm. Never self-conscious about going out to eat with other people. Or...
Right. Now it's more just financial stuff. Like, oh, do I have the money to go get something nice and expensive? Or do I have to just, like, make a sandwich to save some money? Those are the only food problems I have these days. It's not about, you know, what it is, just about how much it costs. Those are the numbers now.
Yeah. Well, is there anything I haven't asked you that you want to say?
Oh, man. Not sure. I feel like we've... I don't know. I mean, I'm still getting used to all this, you know, trying to talk. I like to talk about it. I'm just not good at it.
Yeah.
I like questions and stuff. And you've been doing a good job of asking questions, and hopefully I've been answering them all right.
Yes, you have. You're fine. Do you have any questions for me?
I mean, I know you said it was about the control and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you still have those days where you're, you know, got to think about it and be like, hey, you know, we are not eating enough. You still have those sort of days, you know, all these years later?
I do, because I have so little control over my body with,
right.
Especially with having Ehlers-Danlos. Ehlers-Danlos is a disorder of collagen, and collagen is in every one of my body system, which means that I have no control over what my body does. My
oh,
whole
man.
Body comes up. And that'll trigger.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I can't plan for a day. You know, I planned to be here, but I didn't know what my world was going to look like when I was my eyes this morning. I didn't know if I could be here, you know?
Yeah.
And so sometimes that'll trigger, like, well, I can control what I eat, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I just actively work on that. Well, too bad. You've got to eat, because if you don't eat, it gets worse. So,
I know I kind of talked about that moment where I realized, you know, I was like, right, you know, when I admit I had to go to the hospital, what was your moment where you're like, you know, I got to get better. This is not normal.
It wasn't one moment. It was, I think, a series of moments, strangely enough, when men treated me badly. You know, I was in graduate school, and my boyfriend cheated on me. And then when my first husband abused me, there was just moments where someone else was as mean or meaner to me than I was being to myself.
Hmm.
Kind of woke me up and got my attention over and over.
Wow.
That, you know, somebody needs to be kind to me, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a process of slowly waking me up. And it helped that I am incredibly sober. I think that's what it is. I think if I weren't this stubborn, I could have done it. But yeah, it was just a series of the men I was with being so mean to me that it called attention to the fact that, well, there's nobody in this room being nice to me. You know?
And did any of them ever notice that about your? Did any of them ever notice your eating disorder, or were they just so consumed with themselves that they completely ignored it?
They noticed. I think they kind of used it to their advantage.
Wow.
You know, if I was weak, then they could better further their agenda. You know, if I was sick.
Yeah.
You know, if I felt bad about myself, then they could run things.
It's horrible.
Yeah, I wasn't very good at picking men in my 20s. Yeah, and my boyfriend in undergrad encouraged it.
Really?
Yeah, he would. I remember one specific time, you know, I would not eat, but then when I was a purging anorexic, I would not eat, but then when I did, I would purge. And I remember telling him that I'd eaten a Snickers bar and made myself sick. And he just comforted me, saying, you know, you won't do that again. And I kind of remember feeling, I'm not sure if he means the purging or the eating the Snickers bar. Or both.
Yeah.
I mean, even at the time, like, I'm not sure which he means. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I kind of picked people that fed into it.
I mean, subconsciously, I mean, that's...
Or unconsciously, or, you know. But I think that helped to help me get better, in a way, like I said, because they started being worse than I was, and the contrast showed.
I mean, sometimes you have to get completely broken in order to start fixing yourself. I mean, you reach that lowest low, and then, you know, all you can do is you gotta just get up, and you get better.
Exactly. So yeah, my 20s and early 30s weren't cute. But they made me this, and maybe they made me strong enough to handle being disabled.
And everything for better or for worse, everything always does happen for a reason.
Yeah, shored up my foundation.
Exactly.
So
my cat's over here right now. She's kind of just sitting on the computer.
What's her name?
Her full name is Blizzard the Wizard. She does accept Blizzard.
Hi, Wizard.
Oh, she's a good little kitty, though. When she wants attention, she gets attention. Aren't you, little kitty? Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you want me to know that we haven't covered?
Not that I can really think of. I mean, I think we hit all the points. You asked some good questions. We talked, had a good time. I'm not the most social person, as if you heard, like, I probably mumble a lot here, and I do apologize for that.
I'm socially awkward too. It's cool. I'm home a lot. You're being disabled, so it's cool.
I'm an introvert as well. Most of my interactions are with my little kitty. We have shenanigans together. All right. Well, yeah, I had a really good time. I'm glad we were able to do this. Yours, I mean, you just do good stories like this, and I'm glad I was able to do this story on yours as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to putting this together. Thank you so much, Eli.
Of course, thank you.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
I am spinning the silk threads of my story, weaving the fabric of my world. I spun out of control. Eating was hard. Breathing was hard. Living was hardest. I wanted to swallow the bitter seeds of forgetfulness. Somehow, I dragged myself out of the dark and I asked for help. I spin and weave and knit my words and visions until a life starts to take shape. There is no magic cure, no making it go all away forever. There's only small steps upward, an easier day, an unexpected laugh. A mirror that doesn't matter anymore. I'm thawing. Laurie House Anderson, Winter Girls. If you are currently struggling, or if you have in the past, but this episode triggered feelings, and you just need to talk to someone, please call the Eating Disorders Hotline at 800-931-2237 or 01-494-793-223 in the UK and 1-300-550-236 in Australia. These numbers and the click through to the online hotline chat and email are both in the show notes for this episode. Just look at the episode's description in your podcatcher app. Thank you for listening. Always be looking out for cupcakes. Please don't be afraid to eat one. And I'll see you next week. Love you.